Becoming a mother is a leading cause of high school dropouts for girls in the U.S. One-third of teenage mothers never finish high school, and among first-time adolescent mothers, one in four will have a second baby within 24 months. The birth of a second child while still a teenager often means school dropout, welfare, long-term poverty and dependency for the young mother and her child, children. There we go. There are no disclosures. Today I'd like to talk about the subsequent pregnancy program and two decades of success in helping adolescent mothers delay a second pregnancy, graduate from high school, while being the best mother they can be to their child. I'd like to talk about share with you 20 years of program experience, describe our program model and outcomes, and suggest a few factors we think are responsible for the effectiveness of this program model. The subsequent pregnancy project grew out of empirical research on teenage welfare mothers in Chicago carried out at the University of Chicago in the late 1980s. A longitudinal study of teenage AFDC mothers showed that 3 years later, half of these young mothers already had a second child, a large proportion had dropped out of high school, and almost all were still on welfare. With these results, we went to the state and we said programmatically, couldn't we do something to lengthen the second interval? And they said, yes, do it. At that time, there were no models to delay a second pregnancy. The term subsequent pregnancy didn't appear in the literature. So we started as a small pilot project in 1990. 3 years later, the state asked us to expand the program, and seven different agencies around the state were selected as subsequent pregnancy program sites. Four of these were health departments and three were social service agencies. Three of the sites were in Chicago, two were in suburban areas, and two were in smaller cities outside of Chicago, Rockford and Waukegan. Since 1994, a technical assistance team has worked directly with the subsequent pregnancy home visitors in all seven agencies to develop the subsequent pregnancy model and the curriculum. Since 1994, 4,000 first-time adolescent mothers have participated in SPP. In 2013, 56% were African American, 39% were Latina, and 4% were Caucasian. The mean age at intake was 16.8, and the mean age of their babies was 9 months. Almost all were single, and each year, approximately a third of the young mothers in SPP are on welfare, and almost a half every year are the daughters of teen mothers themselves. Now, among the 4,000 young moms who've participated in SPP, 97% delayed a second pregnancy while they were in the program, and 87% have remained in school or graduated. In 2011, our 20th anniversary year, there were zero repeat pregnancies, zero second pregnancies among participants, and 90% of the young mothers in the program graduated from high school. Every year, between 85 and 90% of these young mothers do graduate from high school or get a GED. And these results are in sharp contrast to national figures. Child Trends reports that only 38% of young mothers who have a child before the age of 18 receive a high school diploma before the age of 22. All of the young mothers in the subsequent pregnancy program have their children before the age of 18. A 10-year evaluation of this program, supported by the MacArthur Foundation and carried out by Philibert Research Associates, reports that the 3% repeat pregnancy rate among subsequent pregnancy participants is substantially lower than other community-based programs around the country. And our high school graduation rate, which is 70% for those participants participants who are 17 and older is twice the national average for pregnant and parenting teens. So now I'd like to tell you about the program model and factors we think are responsible for the effectiveness of delaying second pregnancies and getting our young mothers out of high school. First-year subsequent pregnancy participants receive intense home visiting services coupled with membership in a subsequent pregnancy advisory group that meets twice a month. SPP is a home visiting program, and the personal relationship between each home visitor and the young women, the young mothers on our caseload, is a primary reason for the effectiveness of this program model. The subsequent pregnancy home visitor steps in and becomes surrogate mother, surrogate sister, welfare advocate, school advocate, whatever it takes to keep this young mother and her baby from falling through the cracks. In addition to her home visitor, the participant is participating in a subsequent pregnancy advisory group that meets twice a month. We take training of our participants and the knowledge they gain very seriously as a part of this program model. And each year, the group is closed in the fall so that the same young women move through the program year. And the group itself becomes a strong support system for the common goal of not getting pregnant. Now, if they make it successfully through 1 year of participation and they've attended the required number of advisory group meetings, they are trained as subsequent pregnancy peer educators through an intense 8-week program in the summer. During the second year, they're employed and paid an hourly stipend to be subsequent pregnancy peer educators in their own schools and neighborhoods. Each year, they reach approximately 2,000 other teens with their delay message. And they're very effective communicators when they stand in front of a group and say, "Don't do this. This is hard to be a teen mom and try to stay in school." The subsequent pregnancy curriculum, which is used in all 7 sites, was developed working directly with the home visitors around the state. The same curriculum topic is presented in all 7 sites each month, with a follow-up discussion of that topic during home visits. Now, our SPP participant outcomes have been amazingly consistent over time and across diverse populations of adolescents. Over this 20-year period, the proportion of young mothers in the program who have a second pregnancy has ranged from a high of 4% to 0%. As a home visiting program, the relationship between her home visitor and this young mother is one of the major factors that helps each of these young mothers reach her goals of delaying a second pregnancy and graduating from high school. But a second reason for the program's effectiveness in delaying second births is the intense training and close follow-up provided by each home visitor that allows each young mother to choose the best method of contraception and consistently use that method over time. By the end of each program year, SPP participants are using effective contraceptive methods. The type of contraceptive method used by our participants at year end over the past 3 years, 2011 to 2013, is presented in this slide. Over these 3 years, almost all SPP participants are using the most effective methods, with a large proportion using the LARC or long-acting methods, IUD and Implanon. The low rate of second pregnancies among our participants suggests well-informed and consistent contraceptive behavior among the first-time moms in our program. Now, looking back over 20 years of program experience, we've identified several things that we think are helpful in coming in delaying the second pregnancy and getting these young moms out of high school. The first is the focus on delay. This is something, as program staff, we had to learn ourselves. Most of the young mothers in this program are so needy, and your first impulse is to try to meet all these needs. Well, we had to learn gradually how to help each young mother develop a plan to delay a second pregnancy and graduate from high school. And then all program activities had to help that young mother stay on track with that plan, including correct and consistent contraceptive behavior. Now, as I said, the role of the home visitor is central because she provides one-on-one individual support over a long term. More than half of the home visitors with the subsequent pregnancy program have been with the program as home visitors since 1994. We have six young mothers who graduated from the program, graduated from high school or college, and are now back as subsequent pregnancy home visitors. We've worked directly with these same women over time, continued training and support through monthly home visitor meetings. Now, the knowledge gains in the advisory group about our body, about contraceptive methods, about parenting, about child development and career choices is a valuable resource for each of these young mothers, but it also allows her to give back to her own community as she goes out and works as a subsequent pregnancy peer educator. She provides critical information to other kids in that community that in many of our communities they wouldn't get otherwise, and she serves as a role model. And finally, we've had continued support from the state of Illinois. Without this, we could not have developed the subsequent pregnancy program model or curriculum. This continuous support, albeit at the same level since 1994, has allowed us to adapt the model over time. For example, when we started 20 years ago, crack had just come to Chicago, but violence and homelessness were not the major issues they are for us today. So the continued partnership with the state has allowed us to adapt the model to constantly meet the changing needs of the young mothers in our program. Thank you. I'll be happy to take questions at the end.
So we made some deals. Part of the fundings were provided by under, you know, DPH. So, you know, we had problems with confidentiality, and also college students, they are required to have health insurance. So they can actually have health insurance through the college. So we made all kinds of combinations to allow some kind of billing and keep confidentiality. But the billings did not provide funding for the program. The program was funded by the grant. Yeah. For continuation, so the way the clinic runs in the college, it's not by customers, by clients. The university allocates money for the clinic. So basically what's the next work to be done is to prove the importance and get funding additional allocated in advance for to continue running that specific services.
Could you speak up just a little bit so everybody can hear you?
I know that one of your hotspots that you referenced is Los Angeles County, because I saw I saw some of the media coverage that you got in Southern Cal. Can you mention the other hotspots that you were referencing?
Sure. Actually,
actually, interestingly enough, Los Angeles is not one of our hotspots, and the reason is that our funding stream for California's Fund of Action Project is for the state of California outside of Los Angeles and San Francisco, which is a little bit. However, our organization, California Family Health Council, has programming throughout the state and in Los Angeles. We do advertise in Los Angeles. You can absolutely access the map and find locations in Los Angeles where they can go to receive free condoms, but we don't have a mailer program there. But LA County has a separate mailing. So, I mean, it's really complicated with all of the different funding streams and the programs and our partnership. But the hotspot counties are, so Kern, Sacramento, Fresno, Alameda, San Joaquin, and part of San Francisco,
that's it. So, Maureen, I have a question regarding the subsequent pregnancy prevention program. You mentioned that the relationship with the home visitor is very, very important. So, forgive me if I missed it, but what are the qualifications to become a home visitor?
I'm sorry. Thank you for bringing that up. I did not mention that, and I should have. Unlike most other programs, other home visiting programs, our home visitors are women from the community. They're not nurses. They're not paraprofessionals. They're women from the community who care about these kids and this program. So we have no formal qualifications. Most of them joined us in 94 when the program was just starting. We have a educational level that ranges from master's degrees to high school. We don't require, now when we're hiring a home visitor, we try to get a college degree or equivalent experience. But as I said, six of our home visitors right now are young mothers or young women who came through the program, graduated. Some of them graduated from high school, some of them graduated from college, but now they're back as home visitors. So we run a broad gamut, but they are not nurses and they are not trained paraprofessionals. They are trained, we train them continuously, but they are not nurses.
I have a question since you're up there. I'm impressed with how long you've had support from your state. And I'm wondering, did you develop cost-benefit ratios to sort of keep, so if your funding was threatened, you were able to say, hey, wait a minute, it's pay now, pay later, kind of?
You know, I honestly can't tell you why. I mean, knock on wood, because Illinois is probably, we're broke, as people will know. I mean, we're 50th on the scale here. I have continued to give these outcomes over time, and literally no one else can touch a 3% repeat rate and this high school graduation rate that just continued to increase. We have recently moved from the Department of Human Services to the Department of Public Health. Hopefully that doesn't mean anything, but we have given them annual reports every year. And we do stay at 1994 funding level. So with inflation, that's not a lot of money, but we have had continued support.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Actually, a question for you. Maybe there's a meeting. Oh, so you mentioned that when you want implementers to submit adaptations before they implement a program. But I was wondering if there was anything that kind of marked off if the adaptations that happened during implementation, if there was any way to report those.
So when I say that they, it's not that they give prior approval before they implement the program, it's prior approval before they implement the adaptation.
Right.
So it can happen at any period within the program. And a lot of them do. As they begin to implement the program, they see, oh, this module really, or this component, you know, it's really geared towards Hispanic and everyone in the class is African American. Can we tweak it a little bit to not say Latina or, you know, those types of adaptations? We call those small. Some of those are not necessary. And then we also do track all the adaptations that are met across. In the ideal world, when you're doing implementing an evidence-based program and you make an adaptation, it would be great to evaluate how that adaptation is being implemented. However, because of funding constraints for the individual grantee and for OA, we can't track every adaptation. And so we just pay attention to if the adaptation made sense, and if it doesn't completely change the intent of the model. Now, those in our Tier 2 grantees, they may be making huge adaptations, and then where all of our Tier 2 grantees are being evaluated. And those adaptations, they may use a program, existing program model, and implement it in a new community, or change one of the modules, or add a texting component to it, or add a mobile health component to it. And those grantees are testing and testing with adaptation, essentially intervention. Did I answer your question?
Yeah. Thank you.
Great.
Well, thank you all for coming.